Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. Science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Chris Cherniak, who is covering today for Lynn Ware Peak. As you may know, Chris is from the award-winning show This Green Earth, which airs Tuesdays at 9 a.m. Excellent show. Chris, welcome.
Hey, thanks, John. And you know what? We're all award-winning here, aren't we?
We are.
We all got awards for that. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Our first guest this morning is Randy Lewis, U-Star professor at Utah State University. Randy heads up the Utah State University Bioproduct Scale-Up Facility, which furthers Lewis's work on the creation of synthetic spider silk. 70,000-square-foot facility will house large fermentation equipment, allowing researchers to take the next step in producing large volumes of spider silk protein. Why produce spider silk protein? Well, spider webs are incredibly strong and flexible, and spider silk proteins may someday form durable artificial ligaments for people who have injured their knees or shoulders.
That's really interesting. And our second guest this morning is Aaron Tilton. He's the president and CEO of Blue Castle Holdings. Blue Castle Holdings wants to build and operate a 2-unit nuclear power plant near Green River, Utah. Following a 30-year period in which few new reactors were built, it is expected that 4 to 6 new units may come online in the U.S. by 2020, the first of those resulting from 16 license applications made since the mid-2007s to build 24 new nuclear reactors. However, lower gas prices since 2009 have put the economic viability of some of these projects in doubt. We look forward to our conversation with Aaron.
These two guests and today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
In the cycle of life, we all go through changes, and menopause is one of them. At Intermountain Park City Specialty Clinic, our OBGYNs, Drs. Janine Falk and Lorraine Sabella, care for women at all stages of life. 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Okay, our first guest this morning, Randy Lewis, U-Star professor at Utah State University. Randy heads up the Utah State University Bioproduct Scale-Up Facility to synthesize spider silk protein. Spider silk proteins may someday form durable artificial ligaments for people who have injured their knees or shoulders. Spider silk is 100 times stronger than natural ligaments, 10 times stronger than natural tendons. It's stronger than Kevlar and more elastic than nylon. Professor Lewis, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, fascinating topic. Tell us about your background and how you got involved in studying and synthesizing spider silk protein.
Well, I'm actually a chemist who evolved into a biochemist who's now evolved into a material scientist. And we actually started looking at spider silk over 20 years ago because at the time nobody knew anything about spider silk. They knew quite a bit about silkworm silk. But they didn't know anything about spider silk, except for the fact that it was made out of protein, which was discovered actually clear back in 1908 by one of the stars in the chemical world. And so we were able to clone, after a couple of years, we were able to clone the first spider silk gene and find out what the proteins look like. And the trek has been since then to clone a number of different spider silk genes and in the process design some of our own and produce large quantities. And the major problem is spiders are both territorial and cannibalistic, so it's impossible to really raise spiders in the way that you do silkworms. The other problem is that the web really is made out of four different kinds of silk with very different mechanical properties, so it really doesn't do you much good to collect the web because it's kind of a combination of a whole lot of different things, which isn't really very useful for anything.
Silk type and strength vary with different types of spiders? Like, who are the good spiders out there? whose
That's a really interesting question. So if you take the group that we're most interested in, that's the ones that make the typical orb web, the circular web, turns out that for 150 million years, they have done very little change in their silks. And so they are all very close to each other. There are some that vary, you know, a little bit stronger, a little bit more elastic, but for all intents and purposes, they really fall on a very, very similar group. If you look outside of that group, for spiders that don't use their web to capture their prey, those have diverged enormously to the point where typically we can use a computer algorithm to be able to say, you know, these genes are related in this way, and even to predict how long ago they diverged. If you do that with these other spiders and compare them to themselves and to the orb weavers, you really can't do that. The computer programs break down because they're so dissimilar that there's no real way to be able to find them.
So if you put spiders in the same space, in the same captive space, they'll eat each other.
They will kill each other and eat each other until one of two things happens. You either end up with one left or the last two end up killing each other, which is an interesting Romeo and Juliet thing. So.
Well, quite a battle. So because of that, you need to coax other organisms to produce spider milk. And so far, goats, silkworms, and I think alfalfa. How do you coax a goat to produce this protein?
What?
So it turns out that it is well understood the regulatory system to produce proteins in milk, and so it's a set of DNA instructions. So what we did was we attached those DNA instructions to our spider silk gene. We transferred that information into an embryo, and at a certain frequency, that gene gets our new gene gets incorporated into the chromosomes of the goat, and those embryos are then transferred into recipients, and 5 months later, you have a baby goat, and we can check the DNA and make sure that we have the right one there. 5 months later, that presumably female is ready to breed, and 5 months later, we have a goat making milk for us.
Have you figured out how spiders do this, you know, in their gut or whatever their mechanical processes are? Like, what are they combining? You know, what's chemistry is going on inside of them?
So they make six different silks, the orb weavers do. And they have six different sets of glands, and each of those makes a different silk. And the key is that the proteins, for whatever reason, are stable while they're inside the gland. But as soon as you pull that material, which is very viscous, you form a fiber. So it gets pulled like floss. It doesn't get squeezed like toothpaste. So they actually use their hind legs, or they attach it and pull it out from the spinnerets at the very end of their abdomen.
So you have some sort of electronic capability to be able to simulate this pulling to be able to make the fibers?
Right. So we've actually we're in the process of actually getting a brand new instrument delivered here shortly. Hopefully by the end of this month, we actually got some video of how it's being at stages of operation. But what we can't do is we can't mimic the initial step of being able to pull it. So we squeeze initially out a very fine tube, and then we start pulling. And so we have an instrument that basically can stretch. At different lengths, we can put it through a different solution, because initially as we've spun it, unlike the spider, ours is pretty lousy, but then if we stretch it in a rubbing alcohol water bath, and then a water bath, we get materials that are anywhere from half to two-thirds as good as the natural material, which, as you mentioned, is still perfectly acceptable and actually better the natural ligaments and tendons. So we actually can make material now that's better than natural ligaments and tendons.
And a 70,000 square foot facility is not insignificant. What sort of quantities do you believe you'll be able to produce of these proteins and of the actual synthetic fibers?
So the goal is to be hitting kilogram levels on, let's say, a weekly basis, maybe faster than that, but certainly on a weekly basis, the goal is to be able to make kilogram quantities. And right now, a milligram will make you about somewhere on the order of 100 meters. So if we make a kilogram, it's going to be something on the order of 100,000 meters worth of spider silk fiber.
Okay. I had heard on the web there was a TEDx talk by a gentleman who has started a company called Spiber, which produces a product called Cumonus, which I think is the Japanese word for spider web. And he said that right now they're only producing, you know, that they'll work several days to get a spool of fabric or a spool of web. But he said that by 2015, they plan to produce 10 tons a year. Is that feasible?
So we have actually, obviously, we look into everybody who's in this spider silk space. And I won't say it's impossible, but I think it's stretching things.
Yeah.
And no pun intended.
Yes.
So right now I think the difficulty is twofold there, and that is their material, at least anything that we know of that they have produced and published any information about or given information out about, are nowhere near as strong or as elastic as our proteins are. So I think, and part of the reason is they're making much smaller proteins than ours. So the natural proteins are huge, and we're only making proteins that are up to a third as big as the natural. Although we've now figured out, we hope, how to make larger ones. So the smaller they are, the easier they are to make large quantities. So I think the answer is yes, they could reach that. I think that the practical use for those in most situations where people would want to do it, I think is suspect, whether they're going to be able to make materials that are good enough to really capture a market out there on a consumer level.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Randy Lewis. He's a U-Star professor at the Utah State University, and Randy heads up the State University's Bioproducts Scale-Up Facility. And we're talking about synthesizing spider silk protein. All right, let's talk strength. What is the typical strength? Give the listeners an idea of like what a real spider thread can hold weight-wise. I mean, how strong is this stuff?
So it's about, if you look at strength, it's about 650,000 pounds per square inch. Now, in the real world, it turns out that's probably not the number that's most important. It's something we call toughness or energy to break. And so that's how much energy it takes to break a fiber. And you can imagine if you're a climber and you fall, when you hit the end of the rope, you're not weight anymore, you're energy. So how much weight it'll hold may be good if you're hauling things up the rock, but when you hit the bottom of it, you really care how much energy it can absorb. And that's really where spider silk is the star, because as it stretches, it absorbs an enormous amount of energy. So from that perspective, it ends up being 3 to 6 times stronger than Kevlar is, because it can both be very strong and to be able to stretch and absorb more energy.
Wow, so if woven, you know, into a mass, it's stronger than Kevlar. It can stop a bullet.
Yes. So I not so jokingly say that there's no question I can build you a bulletproof vest that will stop a bullet. The problem is that we have a stretch factor. And that stretch factor will stop the bullet on the wrong side of your chest.
Okay.
So the answer is I've stopped the bullet. No, I've not saved your life.
Right.
So
good news, honest, bad news. Okay.
Yeah, so to be honest about it, you know, what we're looking more at in terms of protective kinds of things are blunt force trauma, like reinforcement and helmets.
Right.
Where, you know, what happens is that you get a blunt force trauma, and what we need to do is spread that out over as much of your skull as we can so that it doesn't just slosh your brain back to one end and then back again, you know, leading to brain damage. And so we see that as a more viable approach rather than making a bulletproof vest,
okay,
although there's lots of people in the field who keep touting bulletproof vests.
You know, I don't know anybody who hasn't used Velcro before who hasn't said, man, I wish I had invented this. This would be a gold mine. And it certainly has been. I understand that you just received funding from the U.S. Navy for a project involving spider silk adhesives where you might be able to make something resembling a one-sided Velcro that would stick to anything, even a wet or slimy surface.
Right. So one of the silks that spiders use, it's called an attachment thread, and they're tiny. They're 1/100th to 1/250th the diameter of a human hair. And they put out hundreds of them at a time, and they basically have two properties. One, physically they adhere to a surface, but they also adhere to something that either is liquid-liking or oil-liking. So they have both of those capabilities. So they can actually stick their web to Teflon, they can stick it to glass, they can stick it to plastic. And so that project is really to see if we can't clone that particular gene, make enough of the protein, make very fine fibers, and allow that then to be able to be used as you mentioned, just a one-sided Velcro. That is, you just slap it on and it automatically sticks.
Wow, great application.
Okay, let's. In the intro, we talked about as an example of its strength that it could be used to replace natural tendons and ligaments. Talk a little bit about that application.
So right now we have a team that's working on a prototype for a replacement or repair for tendons, and the idea is that we know this material, or at least the natural materials in some of our synthetics we've tested, are tolerated by the body very well, so they don't form an immune response. So we expect to be able to implant them without having the possible difficulties that you might need there. And the real problem with, let's say, a rotator cuff, which is one of the real hang-ups now, particularly in older people, is that if you tear it, you suture it together, and then you have to mobilize the limb. And what you have happen is that instead of replacing it with tendon material, you end up with scar tissue. And the scar tissue is not nearly as strong as you need to be. So one of two ways we can do it. One is that we can just put a replacement in there, and if we design it right, it will slowly be taken over by natural tendon material. Or we design a sleeve that will actually allow the material to at least use some physical therapy by allowing the tendon to have some range of motion, which most people believe will then lead to replacement of the tissue and not scar tissue formation. So we're looking at sort of both of those types of applications.
Wow. Who is helping you fund this work right now?
So right now we're strictly dependent on grants. We have conversations going with three multi-billion-dollar companies who we hope are going to decide that they want to help us out with the funding. But right now we've got funding from the Department of Defense, from National Science Foundation, mm-hmm. from the Department of Energy, and then we have been funded by the National Institutes of Health, and we're back in talking to them about getting funding, particularly for the ligament and tendon work.
We had a gentleman on the show a couple months ago, Mark Porter. He's the director of the Nano Institute for the University of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And in talking with him and in speaking with other people at Utah State, there's a tremendous amount of technological study that's going on in this state. Do you work collaboratively with these other groups or other organizations?
Yeah, we do. So, you know, one of the nice things through USTAR, and particularly we're working with the ones here at Utah State, just because, you know, the availability is there. But we do, we have discussions and various overlap with groups down at the U. And I think as we develop more on the medical end of things, we'll be seeing a much stronger effort in that way. As soon as we start looking at prototypes, they have obviously the medical school, and they have people who are, very skilled in biomaterials and things like that for human applications. So I expect that things will increase substantially in that direction over the next couple of years.
Well, this is really fascinating stuff, although I would suggest that carve out part of that 70,000 square feet and hire a behavioralist specializing in spider behavior to get them to get along better, because it's not good when your production team is killing itself,
killing each other. You're absolutely right there.
Well, goats like each other.
Okay, well, yeah.
Our goats do, plus all my students do. So,
So we talked about goats. How about alfalfa?
So alfalfa is one we actually started before I got here, but see that as a major opportunity for huge scale-up, because we would be able to, get kilos per acre. And obviously in the Cache Valley, alfalfa is a huge crop, particularly as far as the dairy industry goes. And the advantage for us is that after we remove our protein from the alfalfa, we're still going to have 98% of it left. And so we could turn around and use that for feed, which eliminates, you know, problems with genetically modified waste. And secondly, we probably can actually pay for processing by using that. And obviously, the advantage is you just continue, you know, you scale up, you grow more acreage, and you get more material to be able to work with. So that one is certainly on the radar. The real sort of, I think, question is going to be in terms of getting all the necessary approvals to get it out there. But since there are genetically engineered alfalfa already out there, it isn't like we've got to rebuild the world to get that kind of a permit.
Yeah. Professor Lewis, besides the several billion-dollar companies that are that you're currently talking with, are you talking with folks within the venture capital community in Utah?
We've had visits from a couple in terms of working with this, and you know, I'll be blunt about it. The problem is that we fall into sort of a big hole. So there are those who know how to do commercial things. There are those who know how to do medical things, and we're sort of in this netherland that I think people are still trying to get a handle on in terms of, you know, what's the upscale potential, where, you know, what are the timing for being able to get products on the market, those sorts of things. So, I would love to see venture capitalists who want to jump in and help us out. There isn't any question about that. But I think, right now, like I said, we've had conversations, and nobody said no, but nobody's jumped up and said, you know, hey, this is something that I'm sure my people want to invest in.
And John mentioned some other companies that might be doing similar work. Are there, you know, your competition, let's say, not just in this country, but other countries, you're seeing parallel work going on?
Yeah, and again, the reason that I feel like we've differentiated ourselves is, as I mentioned, first of all, is the size of the proteins that we make. But the second is the diversity. So there's a company called AmSilk over in Germany, and we actually met with them, with the CEO of that company about 3 weeks ago, and we're talking about possible joint ventures with them as well as joint ventures with Spiber. And there again, you know, their proteins are smaller, they have a limited repertoire, and I have to say that in both Spiber and in AmSilk's, are very interested in the fact that we haven't published it yet, but we have developed a spinning technology that eliminates the need for organic solvents. And that's huge, because if we can use just a water-based solution, then large-scale manufacturing becomes enormously easier, because you just simply don't have to work with the organic solvents. So we're very excited about that breakthrough. And those two companies, I think that's the major reason that they would like to talk about joint ventures with us, as we've developed that technology and they could use it.
Professor Lewis, do you see your organization as the provider of the synthetic protein, and outside concerns like these multi-billion-dollar companies as the companies that come up with the actual commercialization of specific products? Or do you see yourself involved vertically throughout the entire process?
Well, I think in a perfect world, what we'd like to do is work with them to develop prototypes. So we would take our materials, we'd help figure out which proteins and which processes would be ideal for them to be able to use our materials. And then, you know, once we reach that stage, then if they want large-scale production, to actually move large-scale production to them. And our effort really is in helping in prototype development and device development.
We have folks here in town in Park City who attend the university, Utah State University, they may be listening in right now. Can you tell us, if somebody was attending, what classes they would take to learn more about this or be able to work in the facility in some capacity?
Sure. So the majority of our students are biological engineering students. We have a tremendous biological engineering program here. It's actually probably one of the top half dozen in the country. The other is coming through biology. I have a number of students who are biology, who are interested in the molecular biology and biochemistry and the things. And so that's where most of my students, those two are the majority of my students, there. So those are certainly the easiest entrees into the area of research that we're doing.
Professor Lewis, we want to thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation. Randy Lewis, USTAR professor at Utah State University, heads up the Utah State University Bioproduct Scale-Up Facility to synthesize spider silk protein. It's not a small little lab off in the corner. 70,000 square foot facility. And is that under construction right now, sir?
It is. As a matter of fact, the walls are just about to start going up. They put in all the foundations, and hopefully we have walls up, because they said they'd have it ready by the beginning of March. So
okay.
We're seriously looking forward to that.
Well, Cool Science Radio would like to arrange a field trip down there to meet you in person.
I would love to have you come visit. We'll have spiders and artificial spiders and everything else you need.
Fantastic. I might even bring a goat with me.
There you go. Well, we can provide you one if you don't. So.
Okay. We will be back after these messages. Thank you. Stay tuned.
Thanks.
You're invited to Fun Friday Fall Fest every Friday at 9 a.m., where John and Jan poke a fun at the myriad of merriment to be had this fall.
Join us for our candy countdown.
Call in to win our candy quiz.
Fall Fest, Friday Fest.
October Fest. Brought to you by Wasatch Pub and Squatters Pub and Brewery.
All Seasons Adventures.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
And Foothill Oriental Rugs.
John, get out of the candy.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Egyptian Theater presents First Winter Blast, an annual fundraising gala at Montage Deer Valley, Saturday, November 2nd, with special musical guest, the Lowrider Band. This is a winter-wide event, replete with five-course dinner, silent auction, open bar, and dancing to Lowrider Band's mega hits like Why Can't We Be Friends, Cisco Kid, and Spill the Wine. Support the Egyptian Theater at First Winter Blast. Tickets are $250 per person and can be purchased at parkcityshows.com or 649-9371. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Chris Cherniak. He's John Wells. We just got done talking with Randy Lewis, a USTAR professor at Utah State University, all about spider silk protein, synthesizing spider silk. I'm picturing missile catchers. That's what I want. You want to get the Department of Defense?
Oh, I can imagine the Department of Defense would love and love this and have several applications in mind.
Yes, exactly. Or Homeland Security or so. Anyway, let's move on to our next guest. Really interesting topic, really interesting guest, and that's Aaron Tilton. He is the president and CEO of Blue Castle Holdings. Blue Castle Holdings is hoping to build and operate a two-unit nuclear power plant near Green River, Utah. Aaron, thanks for joining John and myself on Cool Science Radio this morning.
Good to be with you, Chris and John.
Hey, well, let's start with a little background on the plant itself. What size plant is this in terms of, say, megawatts?
Well, we haven't selected the technology vendor yet. But the range that it will be initially, the first permit will be for, is between 3,000 megawatts and 2,200 megawatts.
2,200. That's a big facility. Like most coal-fired plants, natural gas plants operate within the range of, say, well, they can be as small as 800 megawatts to well over 2,000. So nuclear power plants put out a lot of energy, and that's two units of these. So, but like you say, that's still in design, and that'll be determined down the road.
That's correct. Yeah, you would be looking at two 1,000 megawatt units or two 1,500 or so megawatt units.
Okay, and what is the typical? What would be kind of the footprint? I know this is also going to be a design component to be determined, but how much space does that take up, acreage wise?
Well, yeah. So we have. For the overall plant site, so the entire site, which includes some dead space, essentially, about close to 1,800 acres that would house all the facilities, everything that was there, and include the half-mile radius exclusion zone that we control.
Mm.
So, but for the actual footprint of the plant, you're talking, you know, maybe 50 acres or so, something along those lines for facilities, cooling towers, a little bit bigger for the we'll have a reservoir that will essentially be about 100 acres. So it's not significant in the sense of what the overall acreage for the site is, you know, maybe 150 acres total for all facilities.
But about 100 acres plus or minus set aside for the reservoir for cooling water. Okay. And one last, you know, kind of visual thing here is it's talked about being down in or near Green River. Is it going to be, you know, downtown Green River or just outside of Green River? Any idea?
No, it would be about 3.5-4 miles west of downtown Green River.
Okay. So right now, where does it stand with respect to its permitting process? Give a sense of the arc of the time and effort involved to permit, design, and ultimately construct and put online a typical nuclear power plant.
So initially, what you're faced with when you're looking at a project like this, you've got to acquire the basic assets. Land, water, location, kind of go through a sifting process. And we started that the beginning of 2007. So here we are, 2013. And so included in that time frame, you still have to now do about 4 more years worth of analysis, regulatory compliance with the NRC. They go through a review of the permits, the applications. So you would have a license to construct and operate the plant sometime, if there are no hiccups or no glitches, about 2017.
Wow.
So you're talking...
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead.
So 2017 to get to the actual construction, or just the completion of the acquisition of the license?
That would just be the license.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we'll have had about 11 years into it by the time the license is done.
And then once you get the license, that's basically granting you the opportunity to move forward with permitting,
then
design, and construction.
You can build, and that process essentially takes about 7 years, and the way it works is that when you're building two units, you stagger start the unit. So you would start one unit, 2 years later you would start the other unit for construction, and then they would kind of finish that way. So you would have one unit done in about 4.5-5 years, and then the next unit would take another 2 years after that.
Wow.
Aaron, let's talk about the economic argument. Currently the nation, on average, pays about 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Somehow in Utah we've become very efficient and we pay about 7 cents per kilowatt hour. Your critics point out that a nuclear power plant produces electricity that costs in the range of 13 to 18 cents per kilowatt hour. Is that due to the decrease in the cost of natural gas, or can you talk about the economic argument?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We are getting from vendors like Westinghouse and General Electric and other vendors who are suppliers that have experience building these. Right now there are 4 Westinghouse units under construction, and there are several in Japan and China and other locations around the world. There are 71 nuclear power plants under construction. So the costs are very well known. Outside of the U.S., inside, I would say it's less certain. But the numbers that we're getting are about 10 cents a kilowatt hour for the retail or the wholesale cost. So I think it's very competitive. What that essentially means is that when natural gas is at about $7 to $8 a decatherm, nuclear and natural gas generation are at parity. So I'm not sure where they're getting their numbers. I can tell you this, that in some of their situations, when the detractors from a nuclear project, when they talk about their numbers, they're not accurate. I won't go into a lot of the details, but we don't operate off of the numbers that they have. We look at it, say it's about 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
No, we certainly understand there's a lot of emotion behind these arguments, and I'm sure you butt heads with that on a regular basis. I will point out, though, in reading about the Jenkinsville, South Carolina plants, which are under construction, that they've had 6 rate hikes in the last 4 years just to fund construction, although their construction cost is probably going to come in under their original estimate. The rate hikes, I'm not exactly sure where they are now per kilowatt hour. Do you happen to know?
I don't know, but I would say this. I don't think there's anybody, any utility in the U.S., electric utility in the U.S., that is actually dropping their rates. All utilities are increasing their rates because, well, let's take Utah, for example. Utah has benefited enormously from a lot of the low-cost coal resources that they built over the last 30, 40 years.
Right.
They built enormous capacity into the marketplace, so much so that we've been an exporter, historically an exporter of electricity for that last, 30 years, a lot of electricity. But over time, our population has grown into that elasticity in our production, and now we have become an importer of electricity. And so what you've seen over the last, I think, 7 years so far is Rocky Mountain Power, the same thing. They are applying for rate increases on an annual basis to keep up with production and new resources that have to be built and transmission lines that have to be built. So we lived off of the excess capacity that we had built into our own marketplace over the last 30 years. And now we've run out of that excess capacity. So everyone, I think, will, if they don't now know, will understand that we're in the mode as a country of building new generating resources, the new infrastructure, which is going to cost more money. Doesn't matter what you're going to build, whether it's wind, solar, natural gas, nuclear. I don't know anybody that's really building coal here in the western U.S. Most of them have been canceled, but all of the resources are going to be more expensive.
Do you envision the power plants providing all their capacity for the state of Utah, or do you see putting this out on the grid to other states?
Now, we think that half of it will stay here in the state. We've had interest from all the usual utilities here in the state that say if they were to participate, how much they would like or what would be the capacity that they would be trying to participate in. About half of it could stay here in the state, and about half of it would go out to the other marketplaces.
Okay, and I'm curious. I really don't understand this, and that is, would you be distributing the electricity yourself, or do you need Rocky Mountain Power to do this for you?
So we will not be what's called a merchant project or merchant plant, per se, in the sense that you have essentially in Utah, 75% of all the electricity is delivered by Rocky Mountain Power. The other 25% is delivered by municipal utilities or cooperatives. And so in the development stage of a project, this is kind of typical where you have a sponsor who comes in. Sometimes it's a utility, sometimes it's a merchant developer. They build it, but then they turn over ownership to the projects. For example, at Lakeside, PacifiCorp was technically not the developer. They had turned that over to a company called Summit. Summit built the plants, started the development, and then turned over ownership to PacifiCorp. So a lot of times you do that, especially in a situation where you have a nuclear project. We don't have any nuclear operators in Utah, so you have to have somebody with expertise in nuclear development to start it, get the process going, and then essentially de-risk it for the utilities who then take it over. And that's essentially our business model, is to de-risk the project. We will not technically be an owner-operator of the project on a majority basis. That would be somebody else like a PacifiCorp or the utilities. You could have an Arizona Public Service or somebody who operates that, or even have another entity who is not a utility but is or is a utility in another state that come in and operate it as just the nuclear operator, like an Entergy or Exelon, who both had discussions with us about doing that.
Yeah, there are a number of nuclear power plants around the country. Most of them seem to be centered back east. Why are there no nuclear power plants, well, in Utah or Idaho or Wyoming or Nevada? Why are they not out here?
Historically cheap coal.
Really?
You know, that's really the issue. When you look at the east, there are some centers where they have coal, and typically Kentucky, those kind of areas, and they've had kind of the same thing. They don't have a lot of nuclear. They have mostly coal, but then on the other locations in the eastern population, they have a lot of nuclear, and that's really the primary reason. We've historically developed coal assets because we mine coal here.
Okay, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Aaron Tilton. He's the president and CEO of Blue Castle Holdings, and that's a group that wants to build and construct a two-unit nuclear power plant down near Green River. And speaking of Green River, let's turn to one of the major challenges or controversies associated with building a plant down there, and that's water use. If I understand correctly, there's an estimate that this facility would require roughly 53,000 acre feet, which, if my engineering, my numbers are correct, is about 17 or so billion gallons of water. What time period is that? Is that what's required per month, per year, over the life of the project? How does that broken down?
Yeah, let me back up just a little bit and provide a little context. So 53,000 acre feet is what we have under the two change applications that we would that we have leased. And if we do two units at 1,000 megawatts, it would reduce that consumption essentially by about a third. So it wouldn't be the full 53,000 acre feet of water, but if we did the full 3,000, then we would probably use that 53,000 acre feet. And that would be on an annual basis. And to maybe help put that in a little perspective by what we do currently, the state uses right now about 2.2% of its water allocation and diversion for generating electricity. And so as a project, we would increase the state's generation by about 50% again, so, you know, 3,000 megawatts. State uses about 6,500 or so, depending on peaking and these other things, based on the load. But we would increase the state's production by about 50% and use less than 1% of the state's, of Utah's diversion.
Right.
So the state currently uses about that same amount to generate the same electricity with the current thermal plants that it has in the form of coal or natural gas or these other things. So we don't see it as a significant issue, and I don't think others do when they understand the context, that to get 50% more electricity in the state, you use another 1% of your water.
Right. I mean, that's a small percentage of what's coming out of the state's waters, let's say. But what percentage of that is being drawn out of the Green River? I mean, you're pulling water out of the Green River on a daily basis.
About a percent
for cooling.
And a half a year.
So what is that the same?
The amount of water that goes through or past the Green River Station, the gauging station, depending on, you know, a wet or dry year, let's say between 4 million to 6 million acre feet is kind of what the ranges are, we would be drawing, again, 53,000 acre feet of water. So in some cases you're talking less than 1%. In some cases you're talking a little over, you know, 1.5% of the water. The gauging stations, the technology that they use to gauge the amount of water that goes through the river just upstream from where our location would be to divert it, has an error margin of essentially somewhere between 3 and 7%. So our withdrawal is actually wouldn't it couldn't even be measured on that basis using the gauging station. So it's very, very small compared to what's being delivered by the river at that location.
And is any percent of that returned to the river?
No, we don't return any of the water to the river. Here in the western U.S., we typically don't use what's called once-through cooling.
Right.
So in an eastern part of the country, you'll see these big hyperbolic towers. You know, they're 300-400 feet tall, and they divert a large volume, or they'll be on a lake or something where they divert a large volume of water and cool it through. The water passes through once. We don't use that in the western U.S. We use basically a mechanical draft. So if you've seen the cooling towers by the Lakeside Project in Utah County or other places, or virtually any other coal plants in Utah, they have a mechanical draft tower that's about 30, 40 feet tall, and it uses a fan. And then they cycle the water through about 25 times to get efficiency. So it withdraws less water. It'll withdraw less water, but consume a little more in the form of evaporation. The water is just put back into the atmosphere as steam, so then it
right.
comes down as rain again.
Okay.
And when it's put into the atmosphere, it's essentially inert. There's, you know, 99% pure steam coming out of the cooling tower.
I see. So the water's pulled out of the river. It's put into this reservoir, 100 acres or so. And then that reservoir is used as the source of cooling water. And any water there might be sent back to the reservoir to be recycled periodically until it evaporates. And then you're just drawing out of the river to supplement what's lost in evaporation?
That's correct. There would be a constant withdrawal. We would do about a 70 CFS, or if you imagine something that's 10 feet high, 7 feet wide, and 1 foot thick, that's what's being drawn out of the river on a consistent basis, or what's called 70 cubic feet per second. And that's about what would be consumed.
Okay.
And
so
of course,
it's like a canal, you know, like if you had a canal somewhere that irrigates farms and these kind of things, that's about what it's like.
Okay.
And, of course, Utah is landlocked at Seabrook, New Hampshire, Seabrook Power Plant. It's right on the ocean in New Hampshire, and they cycle the water through. They warm it up a little bit, but they put it back right into the ocean. But
that's right. They have smaller evaporative losses, so they consume less water overall.
Right.
But they withdraw more from the source. And in our case here, regardless of what technology you use, whether it's nuclear, coal, or natural gas, we don't have, you know, massive, you know, an ocean
right.
or these types of things. And so we want to have less environmental impact by withdrawing less water.
Right.
Aaron, this past August, Utah Governor Gary Herbert endorsed an Oregon company's bid to build a small modular nuclear reactors under U.S. Department of Energy program, and five other Western state governors supported this as well. What is a small modular reactor, and where else have they been used effectively?
Well, we would support that and do support that concept as well. We think that small modular reactors have a place in the nuclear fleet for the U.S.
But what is
modular reactors are essentially... Yeah. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, you know, what are these things?
Yeah, essentially what they are, if you would think of a large reactor, and that is the dome-shaped, if driven by, say, San Onofre or some other nuclear power plant or Palo Verde, you'd see a dome, a contained big concrete dome. Inside there is essentially a boiler. And it's very similar to coal-fired process or a combined cycle unit for natural gas. You basically heat up water with a fuel source. And in the case of nuclear, it's a fuel assembly. And through a reaction, it heats up to 500 degrees or so and boils water, essentially. It creates high-pressure steam in some cases. And so a small modular reactor is similar or uses a similar process, but what they aim to do with the modular reactor is instead of building it on-site in a construction process, they would actually build this in a factory in a smaller version that would fit on a rail car. or some other mode of transportation. So they would manufacture it at a plant, put it into, you know, a rail car or something, and ship it to a site, and then build the remaining balance of plant, you know, steam turbines and these kind of things on site. So they're smaller in size, so instead of being 1,000 megawatts like an AP1000, they would have something like the M-Power modular reactor is planned to be at 180 megawatts. There are some advantages to that, one of which is that if you are a small utility, some of which we have here in the western U.S., a lot of actually that are municipal utilities or cooperatives or irrigation districts, they don't need 1,000 megawatts. In fact, a lot of them don't even have that type of load to serve. They might need 50 megawatts, or they might need 10 or something for their grill. So you get a group of these smaller municipal electric utilities together, like a UAMPS, who is proposing or participating in the project that you'd mentioned before that the governor is supporting in Idaho. So it would develop a smaller amount of power on a scaled basis that is more like a manufacturing process, and allow them to do it economically under a smaller overall cost of project.
Okay.
The cost of electricity that's proposed to come from those, I think, is fairly comparable to a larger plant, although you still have to have a lot of the same infrastructure for a small plant that you would have for a large plant. So they have to build several of these. So you'd say over a period of, you know, 15, 20, 30 years, you would have to install 3 or 4 or 5 of these to get the economics that a large plant has right off the bat.
Okay.
There's some initial benefits getting into it, but you have to wait for a while for the economies of scale to kick into it over a period of time. So it's okay. A little different way to deploy it, although we don't believe that they'll be commercially available for another 15 to 20 years.
Okay. Aaron Tilton, he's...
So that's why we have not...
I'm sorry.
We haven't looked at small modular reactors in a significant way because we plan to have our project online before they're commercially available.
Aaron, we'd love to continue this conversation, but we're tight for time.
Yeah,
but we want to thank you very much for joining us this morning. Fascinating conversation.
Thanks a lot, Aaron. And we'll
appreciate it. Anytime.
We'll be in touch. All right. Let's take one quick break for some last underwriters. We'll be back to wrap up and maybe get our Cool Science story in. It's Cool Science Radio. Stay tuned.
Donations to Park City's ReStore reduce landfill costs for residents and builders and prevents tons of material from entering the waste stream each year. And proceeds from resale of your donated items help fund Habitat for Humanity affordable housing programs in Summit and Wasatch counties. ReStore is open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6, and is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch counties is a nonprofit organization.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. You know, I just bumped into Jan Williams, co-host for Fun Friday. And on tomorrow's show, they're going to be talking about everything Halloween. If you know Jan, candy and cake will be one of the topics. But anyway, Fun Friday tomorrow. We'd like to thank our sponsors, 350 Main and the Spur, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Real Estate. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Join us next week for another edition of Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.